top of the morning, top of the week. This is We Ourselves. I'm Ambrose Eileen Sr. I've got a treat for you today. We're going to interview Dr. Donald Earl Collins. He's written a book titled Fear of a Black America, Multiculturalism and the African American Experience. Welcome to We Ourselves.
Thank you.
Yeah. Want to try that again?
Thank you. Thank you for bringing me here today.
You weren't being heard because of the technical thing. That's the reason I wanted you to do it again. Tell our listeners how you chose the title and why you chose that particular title.
Well, choosing the title is pretty easy. I wanted to find a title that was provocative, that would draw people to the book, because the book, in fact, does discuss the issue of fear around multiculturalism, diversity, African-American culture, and really culture in general in the American context. So I drew it from popular culture. You know, I'm a Public Enemy fan, and Public Enemy came out with an album about 15 years ago called Fear of a Black Planet. And so it seemed to fit. So let's try Fear of a Black America with black in quotation marks to denote pretty much anything that's outside the experience of mainstream Americana, including, of course, African-American culture. Why I chose it, again, is around this whole issue of fear. This book is formed out of a lot of research that looked at the development of multiculturalism during the 20th century and really into the early 21st. But in doing the book, I realized that even with the supporters of multiculturalism, they were fearful of whatever harmful effects people accepting other people's cultures as being equal to one's own would have. So that's where the whole issue of fear or doubt or skepticism or fear of falling or any other number of things that you can think of with fear comes from.
You had a rather special upbringing. You grew up in Mount Vernon, New York. I want you to describe that upbringing for our listeners because it puts it all into some kind of early focus.
Okay. Growing up in Mount Vernon, the period of time that I talk about in Fear of a Black America really is my preteen and teenage years, which were pretty tumultuous. We're talking the early 1980s. We're talking the period of the first Reagan administration, where my family was pretty much lower middle class. And we went from lower middle class pretty much to welfare poor in a span of about 4 years. My mom had four children during that time frame as well. And my stepfather and my mom converted us to the Hebrew Israelite religion for 3 years during that time frame as well. And all of those kind of created a unique experience for me. Mostly not very good, but certainly unique.
Now, there are several branches. Is this the branch that's in Israel now?
I wouldn't really know.
Okay.
I only spent 3 years in a religion.
Okay.
What I do know is that there's certainly plenty of branches in the United States around the Hebrew Israelite religion, which, for those of you who don't really know what being a Hebrew Israelite really means, it essentially means that you're a black Jew, that you can trace your lineage back to the 12 tribes of Israel going back several millennia, something like 5.7 millennia or something like that. And so all of those different things coming together brought an epiphany to me in a way that you don't really expect a 12 or 13 or 14-year-old to have, which is, who am I? Why am I here? Who created me, if I was created at all? And what's my focus? What's my destiny? Where am I going? And with all of those experiences, which were mostly negative, because, of course, you go to a mainstream school with people from different cultures and backgrounds, and you tell them that you're a Hebrew Israelite. And mind you, this is...
And you wear the evidence, right?
Right. You're wearing kufis. Yeah. Wearing kufis and yarmulkes. You're wearing the full garb. You're practicing pretty much the orthodox version of Judaism, which includes kosherizing food, which includes celebrating the high holidays and high holy days, which includes Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, Passover, which just passed this past weekend. those kinds of things. And if you're in a classroom or if you're around folks who happen to be more traditionally Jewish or Roman Catholic or Baptist or whoever, anything other than Hebrew Israelite, they tend to see you as an outcast.
And you're a black Hebrew Israelite.
Exactly. And not to mention the fact that my family situation was not compatible with with being a Hebrew Israelite at the same time. You need to have money to be a Hebrew Israelite, to be able to kosherize food, and we didn't have any. For lack of a better way of putting it, we were in a situation where practicing the 613 laws of the Torah was not compatible with the way we were living. And I couldn't reconcile that mentally, so I went on some sort of a spiritual journey to try to figure out, well, if I'm not a Hebrew Israelite, then who do I want to be? And between school and home, between having classes that actually introduced you to religion, such as Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam, and actually going out on my own and actually reading some of those main texts, I came to the conclusion that I liked the theme of redemption, which in effect brought me back to Christianity. Mm-hmm. And eventually I became a Christian when I was 14. But in all of that, it introduced me to other people's cultures and other people's contexts and, frankly, other people's baggages as well. And it made me not feel as much as an outcast as I felt going through that whole very, very stressful process.
Now, that didn't last throughout your school career, did it?
It lasted 3 years, but when you start off with the same group of people, say, in seventh grade, and you're walking around as a Hebrew Israelite, and then the next 3 years later you've declared yourself a Christian, it's not as if people are going to accept you with open arms. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous. I was pretty much, I wouldn't really say an outcast, but I wasn't exactly in the in group either throughout junior high and high school as a result of all of that. But it also gave me, because I was sort of outside of the fray, gave me an extra bit of insight into what other people's ideas about culture, ideas about religion, ideas about what America's supposed to be all about, and what they in fact thought America really was versus its ideals, that I wouldn't have had otherwise. There's just no way I would have had that without having gone through that very stressful and to some extent insulting and embarrassing experience.
And you also were in a very special educational program while you were there, weren't you?
I was in what was called a humanities program, which was a magnet program. It was an upper crust magnet program. And as I've come to learn over the years, like most magnet programs, they were designed essentially to keep white kids in a predominantly African-American school. During the 1970s and 80s, Mount Vernon Public Schools was roughly 70%, maybe 75% African-American, and had been dwindling in terms of the numbers of white students going through that school system throughout the 60s and 70s. So the humanities program was created to keep affluent whites in the school system because, of course, they were paying a good portion of the taxes. And what was so strange about that experience is the fact that while the school system itself was about 70% African-American, the Mount Vernon High School is roughly 3/4 African-American and probably about 85% of color, the humanities program, when I was going through it, was roughly 60% white. So I got to experience this wide range of affluent whites who, prior to seventh grade, I never knew anything about. Didn't even know I was poor, really, until I went through this experience. I mean, when you figure out that your parents are making more in a month than your mom is making probably in 2 years. I mean, you know, that's a pretty shocking experience.
Now, before I let you leave Mount Vernon to go to up south, let me ask you, what happened when you're getting ready to leave and you had a conversation with your science teacher?
It was the science department head, and it was literally the last day of school of high school. It was June 10th, 1987, And I talk about this to start one of the chapters in the book because it really is apropos to how African-Americans understand how they're situated really today. This whole juncture of the civil rights era and how African-Americans from that generation paved the way for so many of us. And I'm not denigrating that. They actually have paved the way for so many of us to rise up in educationally, economically, housing-wise, in every way, shape, or form that we understand the post-civil rights era. Opportunities that we have now, we didn't have 40 years ago. So I'm not denigrating that. But at the same time, let's not overblow it either. I mean, there's still major issues around race in this country. But in any case, I'd graduated 14th in my class. I was on my way to the University of Pittsburgh for undergrad with a half-tuition scholarship. All of my tuition was essentially paid for out of grants and that scholarship. And the loans were really only for, you know, in other words, I was pretty well set as far as school was concerned. But somehow I just didn't do so well in my AP physics exam. I got a 2, I believe. And it's a 5-point scale. But in any case, the story goes that as I'm cleaning out my locker, she pulls me into her office and starts to berate me about how could I let the black community in Mount Vernon down? How could I let blacks in Mount Vernon High School down? How could I let my people down? There's no way that you could possibly have it as tough as any of us did in the civil rights generation. And I'm thinking to myself, let's see, I'm from a family of abuse. I'm the second of 6 kids. My mom is getting welfare payments of the equivalent of $16,000 a year, living in the third richest county in the United States and living in the New York City area. How much worse can I possibly have it in 1987? But, you know, that's what I'm thinking as she's saying all of this. And then she says something which I thought was very strange. And she says that, you know, you couldn't have had as tough as we did because we marched with King. And I didn't know what to say to that. I mean, I'm like, what does that have to do with what I'm going through, for one thing? Number two is what I'm thinking is, so what? Even if you did march with King, there are so many thousands of other people who marched with King. And it might have been a life-changing experience for them. It might not have been. But that's your experience. It doesn't negate what I'm going through. But my point is that with that particular vignette, it kind of talks about the generation gap to some extent between older African Americans and younger African Americans, particularly from my generation, the Generation X generation, where we're the generation that falls immediately after the civil rights movement. And so are therefore expected at least to take up the mantle. And once it came to light that in some respects, the media treated us as slackers, so therefore, we're not really the ones who are ready to take up this mantle, that the civil rights generation still has to be the generation that leads us to the so-called promised land of American equality and freedom. So, I mean, that's the point of that story, but it is an interesting story because it also shapes how I think about multiculturalism.
Now, you go to the University of Pittsburgh, and you get your... Did you plan to major in history when you went there?
No. Mm-hmm. I planned to major in computer science. I thought I liked it. My mom said you can make pretty good money doing it. And at the time, I thought pretty good money was $25,000 a year. So that's what I initially majored in. And then about my third semester, I found myself miserable. I was still doing pretty well. I mean, I wasn't failing or anything, but I was pretty miserable with it. Knew I loved history, always loved history, and just decided that middle of that semester, my third semester, to switch over to history. Mm-hmm. My mom didn't like it, but that's okay. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure if she's gotten over it, but you know, I hope she has, at least anyway.
All right, you got your master's and your bachelor's there, and then you went next door to Carnegie Mellon.
Right.
Yeah. Here you are in Up South. That's my term. Because I also went to the University of Pittsburgh. And I think it's one of the most bigoted cities in the country. Anyhow, how did you get on to multiculturalism?
About 14 years ago this month, actually, I started was finishing up my undergrad at University of Pittsburgh, knew I was going to graduate school, didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew how I was going. And started reading the newspaper just to see, you know, if there, in case I didn't get in or in case I didn't get money to go, what kind of jobs I could find. But as I was reading, I found a New York Times article that was dealing with this whole issue of multiculturalism in the state of New York. How there are these two sides, these Afrocentrics over here and these traditionalists over there, who are arguing over whether multiculturalism was fit for a social studies curriculum K through 12 in New York State's public schools. And then reading through all of that and looking at all those articles, because these articles go back to April, you can look at May of 91, you can look at June of 91, and the argument basically boiled down to this. Essentially, white scholars were afraid to put a multicultural curriculum that treated African Americans as a major player in the development of American culture, essentially as equals. They didn't like that idea. And that we were talking about the founding fathers as these great, not as great men, but also slave owners. Whereas Afrocentrics didn't think the curriculum went far enough. It needed to be more African-centered, more about what Africans, people of African descent did before.
Is this the Jeffries conflict in New York State?
It's Jeffries, it's Schlesinger, it's a host of other people.
Yes. In fact, included the wife of our current vice president, Lynn Cheney.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So tell our listeners who Jeffries was and how that controversy developed.
Jeffries was a professor at CCNY, Community College of New York, City College of New York, excuse me. And he was just one of a number of Afrocentrists in the late 80s and early 90s who came out with a bunch of ideas around creating an African-centered curriculum, not only at the college level, but at the high school and junior high school level. They were advocating that this would create really academic an atmosphere of academic achievement for African-Americans through bringing up the self-esteem of African-Americans, particularly African-American males. And so they concentrated on what Africans did before they came to the Americas, ancient Egypt, the kingdoms of sub-Saharan Africa, and so on and so forth. Rather than trying to deal with the realities of slavery, the dehumanization of slavery, and how Africans in America managed to rise above that, which, by the way, is another inspiring story, but they didn't want to deal with that. He's pretty, you know, in terms of Afrocentrists go, he's pretty far and pretty radical even among Afrocentrists, because his argument essentially is that American culture doesn't have anything of value for people of African descent. That's essentially his argument.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and you say about people on the other side. Let me read what you wrote. It says. If one truly examines the arguments of people like Schlesinger, Ravitch, Bennett, D'Souza, and Lynn Cheney, one would see that there is not much difference between them and the views of white supremacy groups. There's not much difference between an argument for the preservation of the Western canon and the total assimilation of other cultures and one that advocates the purity of the white race. Both arguments are based in fear and the belief that because Western culture has expanded its influence over the past half millennia, it is automatically better. Expand on that for our listeners. What do you mean by that?
Well, let's just take what I just said. If you're a member of the KKK, and just using them as an example, or any Aryan group, your argument is that white culture, whatever white culture happens to be, whether it's from ancient Greece and Rome, whether it's from Western Europe, whether it's from Germany, whether it's what America proclaims itself to be as a Western society, that this is automatically better than anything that comes along, regardless of whether it contributed to the development of Western culture, whether it contributed to the development of American culture in general. So when African Americans come out and say, whether it happened, or whites who come out and say that African Americans have contributed to the development of American culture in all these various ways, whether it happens to be something as superficial as popular culture and hip hop and music, or something as deep as putting America's feet to the fire around issues of equality and issues of freedom and how we understand those sorts of ideals, we're written off. We're written off as essentially invalid. There's no way that we could have contributed to that. And even if we did, we didn't contribute it in all the ways that we say we did. Basically saying that anybody who makes that argument, whether we're talking about Du Bois or Cornel West, is essentially a liar. And there's not much difference between those two arguments. The only difference is that people like Ravitch and people like Bennett and people like Lynn Cheney would never want to resort to violence to maintain the supremacy of white culture. So subtler ways of oppression, economic, educational, and others, are better than just out-and-out lynching people. And that's really the only difference.
No, there's another difference. One difference is you can make a lot of money being a D'Souza.
That's true. Absolutely.
Because every television talk show will get you on to help you sell your book. Same thing with Lynn Cheney. Same thing with Schlesinger. It is extremely profitable to promote that extreme because it stimulates the white juices. That's my opinion.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right. In another essay, now that I think about it, that I've written, I talk about D'Souza and the fact that he represents a new strand of conservatism because he's a person of color. He's not even from the United States originally. He's from India. And yet he's able to talk about issues of race as if I'm talking about them from both from experience and from research.
Nobody asked him, what about the untouchables in your own country that you came from?
Right.
No one asks him that. I've seen him on television show after television show. Here he comes here. He becomes an expert on African Americans. And that, to me, tells the story about fear of a black America by white folks.
Right.
They promote him.
Yeah, well, the reality is that It's not just the media either. It's people who fund D'Souza's research, mm-hmm. that fund the research of people like Charles Murray, who wrote The Bell Curve 11 years ago, and so on. The Olin Foundations, the Heritage Foundations, the American Enterprise Institute, and others who are trying to get that point of view out there, and they're very aggressive about it. And when you have a mainstream media that's essentially owned by six corporations, it's not that hard to get your message out there. And so, yes, it's profitable. But I also believe that these people truly believe in what they're saying. They wouldn't be doing this just for the money. In most cases, I don't believe that. I do think that it's a good motivator. But in and of itself, when D'Souza wasn't making money, he was writing the same things at Dartmouth University back in the early 1980s. So
he picked up quickly on the racism in this country and its value to him.
Right.
He's made a tremendous amount of money. And don't believe that money doesn't play a part. You ask people like David Brock. I've interviewed David a couple of times. The money's great because the right-wing fascist movement in this country pours that money out to stimulate the racism that we see all across this world. And so the money is fabulous. You could write another book and major publisher would publish it if it were on the other side. Look at Tom Sowell. Look at that whole crew at Stanford University, because a couple of guys went up to Stanford to join Tom Sowell.
Right.
You know, because the money is good. I mean, it is steady and extremely profitable.
And I'm not discounting that, but I'm putting it in the context beyond just the money. The reality is that I think most of these people would be the way they are, even if there weren't any money involved. That's all I'm saying. Of course the money's going to be a motivator. Of course they're going to go do and make as much money as possible while saying whatever wild kind of speculation they're saying. But in reality,
and the plutocracy's agent pats them on the head, on the butt as often as they can.
Right. But, you know, part of what I would even argue to some extent is that Afrocentrists made a little bit of money in the early and mid-1990s, too, because they represent the...
In no way comparable.
I'm not arguing that's comparable. I'm arguing that they knew that there was a niche out there, and they filled that niche. That's
no
all
question
I'm saying.
About that.
That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that they made millions and millions of dollars. But, you know, but the fact of the matter is it's more than just money. It's about... it's about preserving money, but it's also about preserving power that includes money.
No question.
That includes the status quo of where African Americans and other groups of color happen mm-hmm. to be. Or if you want to expand on the whole issue of multiculturalism, you can bring in sexual orientation in this. You can bring gender in this. You can bring religion in this. Certainly.
Especially religion.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Our special guest today is Dr. Donald Earl Collins. We're talking about his book, Fear of a Black America, Multiculturalism and the African American Experience. And we're going to open the phones very shortly to take your calls so you can have a dialogue with him. The number to call, 588-0893 or 202-588-0893. I want to ask you to talk to our listeners about what you said when you wrote about Wilbur Wright College in Chicago and their great books program. You say, professors such as Bruce Gans have reasoned that with all the programs created for women, people of color, and gay/lesbians, it was time for a program geared to emphasize the achievements of white males. Talk to us about that.
Well, the reality is that creating any sort of program that's specific towards white males is kind of redundant, which is an understatement. I mean, anything that you see about what happened in 1776, what happened in 1787 with the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution is about white males. It's about rich, WASP males who were slave owners. Mm-hmm. And reality is that if anybody were to pick up a remote to watch the History Channel, just watch the History Channel for like 3 hours, you either see something about Hitler, who's the, you know, one of the worst white males in history, obviously, or you'll see something about the Founding Fathers or FDR or tycoons like Carnegie and Rockefeller and so on and
DuPont.
So forth. Exactly. The whole channel, I would say that 90 to 95% of the channel is devoted towards the history of white males. Now, this is the most popular form of history that's out there right now. Mm-hmm. We're not even talking about what the NEH funds. We're not talking about, which, by the way, does fund other group, other kinds of historical analysis, but a lot of what they fund is around these kinds of issues. Same thing with the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Same thing with any major institution in American society that deals with issues of American history. The first thing that they talk about is not the women's movement. It's not African Americans moving from slavery to sharecropping to the civil rights movement to the post-civil rights era. It's about white males. So creating any curriculum that's devoted specifically towards white males is frankly insulting. It insults me. It insults my intelligence anyway.
Good morning, Colin. You're on with Dr. Collins.
Good morning, Ambrose.
How are you today?
This is Rick.
Oh, how you doing, Rick?
And I would call myself a friend, if not a personal associate of Lawrence Guyot. An admirer of Lawrence Guyot from a distance as a small boy, watching him as he rode the buses and from afar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking to your guest this morning with a memory that was implanted in my brain in my sleep, having my mother been taken advantage of here at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C., not by white men, but by white women. I would ask your guest today about before Frances Cress Welsing and her college experience, the life of Huey P. Newton and the Jewish roots in his family and how that was used to wipe him out of that movement and to destroy not only his mind, but a whole movement. And then I would ask him to move to Frances Welsing and her college experience and what was done to her to run her off of campus.
Well, I can't speak to all the specifics of both. I mean, I'm not a, I don't, I mean, I shouldn't say I don't know anything about Newton. Of course I do. And of course I know quite a bit about Welsing. But the reality is that when you start talking about the issue of African-Americans as activists and as scholars to some extent, and using their scholarship to be an activist around issues of race, you're inevitably going to have people who want to move you out the way, whether it happens to be enlarged white power structure, or more specifically, African-Americans who might be jealous of what you're doing, the civil rights establishment, the CIA, whoever you want to bring into play here in Huey Newton's case, because we're talking about multiple players in his case, not
Absolutely.
Just one. So the reality is that whenever you're doing something that threatens what the status quo, essentially, what you end up with is someone who's a target, and Huey Newton was a convenient target. Now, the specifics about his ancestry and all that, I couldn't even bother to go into that at this point. But the reality is that he was a target.
Mm-hmm.
In Welsing's case, what can I say about the ISIS papers that a lot of people didn't say 10 or 15 years ago? I actually went to a talk that Welsing did about 13 years ago at the University of Pittsburgh. And listening to her talk, I came away with the sense that, I just didn't think it was scholarship, for one thing. It's interesting. I mean, it's a very interesting, melanin theory is interesting. The whole issue around of what sports whites and blacks play is interesting, but I don't really think it really says anything about the way our culture is designed. I think it says more about Welsing than it does about anything that can be useful to either scholarship or to activism in this case. I wouldn't even say it's inflammatory, because in order to inflame, there has to be some degree or kernel of, what can I say, truth to what she says. So, you know, I'm not saying that she wasn't controversial, and I'm not saying that she wasn't run off of campus. I'm sure she was. But I just don't find what she has to say compelling enough to rise to the standard of a Newton, even.
Good morning, caller. You're on with Dr. Collins.
Hi. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Hi. How are you? I actually am a graduate of City College of New York, class of 1990, and I had the opportunity to take several classes at the Black Studies program. I'm from the Caribbean, and I was put off, to say the least, by what I found to be extreme chauvinism in the African Studies Department. It was something that I was very interested in, and I continue to be interested in. But it was at the time under Dr. Jeffries, but it was extremely oppressive, I thought, in the sense of bringing an alternative worldview that didn't necessarily adopt to a melanin theory or a supremacy theory, which I was very uncomfortable with for my own spiritual reasons. I certainly, as a Caribbean person, know what we have accomplished collectively in the diaspora, but it seems that if you weren't speaking locked in step in the voice of the Jeffries model, then you were essentially ostracized, which essentially was what happened to me as a student. Now, it didn't deter me, but I suspect, and I know for a fact that it did, deter a lot of other people from taking the value, not only the historical knowledge, but just the value of some of the more salient points that I thought the department was making in terms of not only our role here, but overall in the diaspora, because of the chauvinism. And it wasn't just the sexism, which was bad enough, but I thought the overall approach of supremacy, which is basically what I found to be substituting white supremacy with black supremacy, which, you know, I didn't really think was what knowledge is about.
Okay, thank you so much for calling.
I have a similar story. Me and a friend wrote an article about 12 years ago that was published in Black Issues of Higher Education looking at Afrocentricity, and we called it Afrocentricity, the Fight for African-American Thought. And what we realized in writing this piece was that there were too many experiences like the previous callers where people were going into African-American history, African-American studies programs or African studies programs and coming out going, well, what did I really learn? What did I learn that's going to help me cope with the realities of American culture? What did I learn that's going to help me understand more about the African-American experience? Not just the experience of ancient Africans in Egypt or Timbuktu or elsewhere, but how does that translate for me today in the 1990s, or in this case, in the zeros in the early 21st century? And yes, the response that we got to the piece was beyond chauvinist. We practically got threats as far as letters responding to our piece over the next 2 months, because we published in August of 93 and we're still getting letters in October of 93 saying that we didn't know what we were talking about. Malefe Asante is a great, who's the father of Afrocentricity, is a great guru. He's taught me how to live my life. And that tells me that it's more than just about, this is not just a philosophy. This is not just a philosophy. This is a way of living, kind of like a religion, kind of like a cult, kind of like being a Hebrew Israelite, actually. And that's what, that to me was the determining factor in whether I went after multiculturalism as a research topic versus Afrocentricity, frankly, because I didn't detect the same level of dogma in multiculturalism that I detected with some people around Afrocentricity.
Good morning, Carl. You're on with Dr. Collins. Good morning. Speak up. Hello. Let's try another one. Good morning.
Good morning, Ambrose. Good morning, Dr. Collins.
Good morning.
How are you? A couple of quick stories, if I could. I think it fits well in this. I was brought up as a white black person, if you can figure that out. My father was Russian. I grew up during the McCarthy era. Hmm. I was hated more than the black people were in my neighborhood. My brothers got beaten every single day in front of the cops. No one cared. And then, so you start to understand discrimination once it's applied to you, which is what most white Americans can't get through their head, because it doesn't happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Them to the other, it's okay. It's like when I was living down in Florida, I got into an argument with a guy who I found out later was a Klansman.
Mm-hmm.
And we were arguing back and forth, and finally I couldn't take it anymore. I said, okay, you're right. I am a racist. I belong to the human race. Which one do you belong to?
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't understand. I said, it doesn't, you know, racism is stupid. What is a white race?
Mm-hmm.
Look at your history. They've been killing each other for the last 1,000 years. It's insane to sit there and say, all whites are the same. All blacks are the same. Good God, we're all human. We are all the same.
Mm. Thank you so much. Good morning, Collie. You're on with Dr. Collins.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I was just wondering, have you ever had Dr. Jeffries on your show?
Oh, God, yes. Many years ago.
Mm-hmm. How many years ago would you say?
Oh, about in the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I just found that the Dr. Collins, is that his name?
Yes.
When he speaks about his experience with Francis Welsing being so many years, I think everybody should be updated. I think that you should invite Dr. Welsing on your show and Dr. Jeffries, and let's see what they're saying in 2005. Because I happen to know Dr. Jeffries and his wife, and, you know, they're very beautiful people, and I feel that the Black Studies Department across this country are very valid because they bring people in touch with their soul essence of who they are.
No question.
And unless you understand this whole concept of melanin and the situation that our people are in right now in 2005, I feel that that is very real. Past, present, and future are all real. and we can't ignore any of them. It's all 360 degrees of the story and the picture of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all valid.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, Collie. You're on with Dr. Collie.
Good morning, brother. How are you?
Good.
And good morning to you, Dr. Collie.
Good morning. Turn your radio down.
As a father who has two children in college, and my daughter is in the Black Studies Department of at Rutgers University, and I would beg to differ with Dr. Collie, Collins, his analogy of Sister Welding. I happen to know her personally. Very respectable sister. I read that book over 15 years ago, and I think her theory is right on point and relative to the time that we live in right now. And to reiterate on what the sister said, it's so valid, because if you understand the whole melanin thing, and if love were so-called expanded across the world, Caucasians wouldn't exist 500 years from now. That's not a theory. That's a fact. Because, you know, I mean, in college, they teach you about the brown germ. And, you know, light is dominant. I mean, light is recessive and dark is dominant. And that's just a fact. That's not racism or prejudice. Those are actual facts.
Well, in response to the last couple of callers, what I would say to this is simple. I mean, it's trite, but the reality is we're all part of the human race here. We're not just African Americans, and we're not just whites. And there are other groups of color involved here besides African Americans, which, frankly, I don't think melanin theory really accounts for, particularly Latinos. But we could go on and on about Native Americans and so on and so forth. Yes, if we start talking about the issue of skin texture and color, and if you were to mix the races in such a way, probably half a millennia, however many years, there would probably not be a whole lot of white folks as we understand them around. But then again, white folks aren't just white folks. White folks vary in skin tone, from being almost as, you know, being pretty dark to being pretty light, from Sweden to Greece. I think the melanin argument, in terms of a logical, philosophical understanding of issues of love, of issues of power, and so on and so forth, that's not about melanin. That's about power structures. And melanin, frankly, doesn't have very much to do with it in the final analysis, because we're talking about social construct and not just skin color.
Good morning, caller.
Good morning.
How are you?
Hello?
You're on.
Yes. I called because I find the author's subject to be very intriguing and interesting, and I wanted to ask, you spoke about, or previous callers spoke about, Huey Newton and Francis Welsing and so forth, and you followed up with the fact that people who are looking to find a niche as an academician being moved out of the way by detractors, and folks who would diminish the impact of one's labors in any scholarly endeavor anyway. What is the role of conformity and the level of credentials as it applies to the validity of a person's works, whether they be in the arena of activism or in a discipline proper, such as science or medicine? And what is your take on artificial or emotional intelligence as it applies to African Americans? I think it was a more or less a broached way of attacking the black psyche, and with this Ebonics movement, the Black English that was out in the early 80s.
Well, let me try to deal with the first question first. The reality is that when you talk about the academic enterprise, what are you talking about? An African-American or Black Studies department, when you talk about a history department, whatever, the reality is that there's sort of a linear kind of march towards being a valid expert or scholar in your field. Usually you have to have the approval of your peers. Usually you have to earn tenure. Usually you have to make sure that everything passes the snuff, the smut test, really, with your peers in order for you to publish a book, publish an article, present at conferences, and even have the leeway to be an activist and a scholar at the same time. And reality is that most of us, most people can't really pass those tests without not becoming an activist in the first place. So there is definitely an issue of conformity around the issue of being an academic. Being an activist is a little different because regardless of what you're an activist about, the media generally doesn't care about your cause. I mean, that's just the reality of it in 2005. Unless your cause happens to deal with Iraq, the Middle East, no war for oil, whatever, you're probably not going to get listened to in the first place. It's very hard as an activist to even take a nonconformist approach because the fact of the matter is there's no real way for you to conform in the first place. What was the second question?
Are you there? No, it's gone. Caller, you're on. Good morning. Speak up. Hello? Turn your radio down, please.
Yes, I'd like to ask the professor, how can you explain the history of the white people? We're not all the same. There's something different about these people. We're not all the same. I think the Francis Wilson had a good theory. Something's wrong with the people. You look at the history of the world. See what they've done through the history of the world. Something's wrong with those people.
Okay.
Well, only thing I have to say to that is if we look at the whole history of the world, what group hasn't committed an atrocity? Yes, because whites have essentially put their stamp on every part of this planet. It means that therefore they've done the most overall damage. But the reality is, when you consider the world, whether you consider the world of ancient Egypt or any other world, what you're talking about are groups of people dominating other groups of people. That's just the reality of the situation. Whether it's because of race or because of status or because of skin color or because of men versus women or whatever, the fact of the matter is there's always been an issue of oppression in this world. So, yeah, I don't know what else to do with the melanin theory other than say that I don't think it's a valid theory. That doesn't mean I'm dismissing African American studies.
Good morning, caller. You're on.
Hello,
yes, you're on.
Good. I was thinking of listening to what it was. I have to admit that I haven't read the book as of yet. But so far it sounds like that you're trying to find, I guess, almost a middle ground where you can be more or less, what can I say, a black American more so than an African American. And I guess I mean that as in the sense that where W.E.B. Du Bois talks about, you know, being black and being American is almost be schizophrenic because one will never accept the other. And I want to know, is that the possibility of you rejecting the thought of Afrocentrism as a viable option? Because it steps away from what you understand of what it is to be an American?
Thanks so much.
Yes and no. I would say that yes, when I talk about multiculturalism, it is in fact the middle ground between what we understand as Afrocentricity and what I understand from white America's assimilation. But at the same time, what Du Bois talks about and what I talk about in this book is really the fact that culture is not some sort of static silo where all the African Americans fit in one silo, or whites fit in another silo, Latinos fit in another silo, and so on and so forth. This is a fluid state of things that that culture is fluid, and that therefore, as a result of its fluidity, we're not just African in nature. We are Americans. And yes, there are some schizophrenic things that go with being African in America and having America, American values as well as, you know, some sort of African descent kinds of cultural values as well. So in that sense, there is some degree of schizophrenia to it, but only in as much as our society is schizophrenic. So,
good morning, caller. You're on with Dr. Collins. Hello.
Hello.
You're on.
Yes, my name is Storm. How y'all doing this morning?
Great.
All right. Basically, I would like to know. I'm just saying like this. From a religious aspect. You know what I mean, no one is given that. I haven't heard anything on that. We heard a lot of philosophy as far as you know, white people and all types of things. I just recently seen the movie Hotel Rwanda, and it showed me the mindset of a lot of just Africans in general. You know what I mean? Regardless if you go to school, anything like that, they want acceptance into this society. I think we've been taking our natural state. You know I mean, as far as men. And just human beings, period. You know what I mean? Black, white, yeah, that black matters to an extent, you know what I mean? But more so, we all being oppressed in this world, you know what I mean? Than just going off, okay, we black, we got problems. Because in the movie, when I seen it, you got one tribe, the Hutu, going against the Tutsi when they had a problem with the Belgium authority, you know what I mean? And they never at once went against the Belgian authority. They were actually going off of what class was higher, you know what I mean? So it's a lot of classism. That's what I see is going on, you know what I mean? More so than just black and white. I think, of course, we've, you know, divide and conquer, but we've been divided down to a point that we don't know who a group to go to. Okay, you're Afrocentric or, you know, you're activist, you go to school, you learn about African. Yeah, it's crazy, brother. That's all I'm saying, you know what I mean? So, okay. I mean, from a religious aspect, where do you think we stand? Because I think we personally have veered off of being men in general, being humans in general. We so far gone from that? We technology, yeah, college, you don't even have humanity anymore.
So, okay, thank you so much.
Well, I can't speak for anybody else. I wouldn't even dare to speak and say that I'm not W, and I'm not going to go out and say that we're all supposed to be Latter-day Saints of Christ walking around evangelizing the world. You know, I'm certainly Christian. I certainly believe that Jesus is my Lord and Savior and that God is my God. But really, ultimately, what it comes down to for me is that most of the world at least believes that there is some higher power that has a larger purpose for each one of us on this planet, besides what we think unto ourselves, that there's a greater sort of thing, there's a greater thing that can't be fully synthesized about what it is that we're supposed to be doing in this world. And we certainly understand that one of the things that we should be doing is coming together and trying to solve the problems that we've created for ourselves, whether we're talking about whites, whether we're talking about class, whether we're talking about religion or whatever.
Good morning, Colin. You're on with Dr. Collins.
Dr. Collins, what is your prescription for objective positive course in African-American studies? And how do you differ between African-American studies and multicultural studies?
I don't think there's a difference really at all. I think certainly with African-American studies that you can teach about the history of ancient Egypt. You can teach about the influence of ancient Egypt on Western culture. I fully believe that Martin Bernal's books on Black Athena are right on as far as that's concerned. You can talk about the growth and development of African civilizations prior to the so-called Age of Exploration. I think you can find a way to link it successfully to the history of Africans in the Americas, not just in the United States, but in all of the Americas. The reality is that when you talk about history, when you talk about culture, you've got to give the whole truth. You've got to talk about the good and the bad and the ugly. And if you don't do that, whether you're talking about African American studies or multicultural studies, then you're dealing in a falsehood anyway.
Caller, you're on quickly.
Yeah, this is Raheem. I was just wondering, you know, it's not just a social construct only, because through the power world there is a definite connection between the denigration of dark peoples around the planet. Yet we know, if we consider the fact that Eve was a black African, as proven years ago by European anthropologists, written in Times Magazine, also put in video by PBS. Obviously, we're one people on this planet. But the problem is that, as you were talking about this power structure is very specifically designed against the darker peoples all over the planet, irregardless. But the fact of the matter is, if you've already set up that construct, then if I invade your white wife, your white sister, your white person,
female, and impregnate her with my black gene, that whole idea that if you're lighter, you're better or whatever, begins to dissolve. That's the point in this genetic annihilation piece, with the meddling piece. It's not so much that this meddling has something to do with the change of the planet by way of the power structure that the white people have already, but that it has something to do with them trying to stop the movement, be it love, be it the black gene, etc. Can you speak on that?
Quickly. All I can say again is what I've said already, and that's the fact that talking about the issue of power structure from the standpoint of talking about melanin, as far as I'm concerned, is really just a bunch of, you know, crap, really, when it comes right down to it. Dealing with power issues revolving around class and race and all of those other issues means that you have to deal with the issue of how it's constructed and not just about skin color and not about just genetics.
Good morning, caller.
Yes, first of all, I just want to say thank you for having the dialogue and discussion. I appreciate that. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, but one of the realities of it is that you can't rule out skin color. No matter how you try to place a mask with it, that's always going to be there. And the color in and of itself has a great impact on the society at large. We've seen it from year and year and year. And no matter how we talk about love and constructive the social thing, that's going to be there. All you have to do, really, is just look at television, which I hate to say that, and it gives you the example. We look at the control and the structure of society. It tells you who is in control and who's in power. And at any time you would say that there's no value in African Americans or the world at large knowing the historical perspective of the black man in America or the black man in the world, if that has no real main significant value, something is wrong. That means all the other ones have no value. So if you're going to rule out ours, you have to rule out all of them.
Okay. Thank you. You've got 30 seconds to Dr. Collins. Well, all I can really say is that no one's saying that skin color isn't important here. All I'm saying here is that it's not the end-all and be-all for trying to deal with the issue of racism. Yes, we live in a colorblind society that's blinded by color. Let's put it that way. I agree with that statement. But if you're going to make the whole issue of melanin into a theory to try to explain both how to deal with race and both where we are with race, then I think that's wrong. It's just simply wrong.
Thanks to you, Dr. Collins, for being here with us. The name of the book is Fear of a Black America, Multiculturalism and the African American Experience. And y'all have a great week now. I'll see you on Friday.
Thank you.